A reading from the second book of Kings, chapter 6. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Now the king of Aram was at war with Israel. After conferring with his officers, he said, "I will set up my camp in such and such a place." The man of God sent word to the king of Israel, "Beware of passing that place, because the Arameans are going down there." So the king of Israel checked on the place indicated by the man of God. Time and again Elisha warned the king so that he was on guard in such places. This enraged the king of Aram. He summoned his officers and demanded of them, "Tell me, which of us is on the side of the king of Israel?" "None of us, my lord the king," said one of his officers. "But Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the very words you speak in your bedroom." "Go, find out where he is," the king ordered, "so I can send men and capture him." The report came back, "He is in Dothan." Then he sent horses and chariots and a strong force there. They went by night and surrounded the city. When the servant of the man of God got up and went out early the next morning, an army of horses and chariots had surrounded the city. "Oh no, my lord, what shall we do?" the servant asked. "Don't be afraid," the prophet answered. "Those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And Elisha prayed, "Open his eyes, Lord, so that he may see." Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. As the enemy came down toward him, Elisha prayed to the Lord, "Strike this army with blindness." So he struck them with blindness, as Elisha had asked. Elisha told them, "This is not the road, and this is not the city. Follow me, and I will lead you to the man you are looking for." And he led them to Samaria. After they entered the city, Elisha said, "Lord, open the eyes of these men so they can see." Then the Lord opened their eyes, and they looked, and there they were inside Samaria. When the king of Israel saw them, he asked Elisha, "Shall I kill them, my father? Shall I kill them?" "Do not kill them," he answered. "Did you capture with your sword and your bow those you want to kill? Set food and water before them so that they may eat and drink, and then go back to their master." So he prepared a great feast for them. And after they had finished eating and drinking, he sent them away, and they returned to their master. So the bands from Aram no longer came raiding into the land of Israel. God's word is life.
Did you hear it? There's so much to hear in this story. Did you hear how Elisha was able to quell the panic in his servant's heart by sharing his vision? The city is fully surrounded by enemy forces ready to invade. But what if Elisha and his servant aren't actually alone? What if, contrary to the evidence, there's far more available to them than meets the eye? Elisha's vision is a theme that runs through the story. It is his gift to see the unseen, to imagine unforeseen possibility. And not only that, there's his courage to trust it and to share it, as ridiculous, as unheard of as it might sound. Did you notice also his way of not going it alone? There's no receiving a vision and then running with it on his own. Every step of the way, we hear him turning to God, asking for help, as though he knows himself to be in the service of something much greater than himself. Perhaps that's where his freedom and his courage come from, to imagine these astonishingly fresh alternatives to the way it so predictably goes down. To draw toward instead of running away from hostile forces. To instruct Israel's king to set a feast instead of slaughtering the Aramean army. I think what we're witnessing is Elisha's holy imagination. I think what we're seeing is his attentiveness to inspiration, such that a radical alternative, a new way forward, is set in motion. It's a beautiful example of Elisha hearing the call to live creatively in response to the crisis he faces. Vision, inspiration, imagination, they're all connected. They're all part of what enables us to live creatively, to be the creative beings that by God we have been given to be for the sake of life, our life, the life of the planet. In the middle of last week, with this theme in mind, I went downstairs to our library in search of Walter Brueggemann's book, Prophetic Imagination. It wasn't there. But there was this other book that caught my eye, entitled, What Do You Buy the Children of the Terrorist Who Tried to Kill Your Wife? Did you catch that? What do you buy the children of the terrorist who tried to kill your wife? I thought, there's a whole lot of imagination going on there. Holy imagination. It is this incredible recounting of David Harris Gershon's search for healing after his wife and friends were among the victims of a terrorist bombing in 2002 in the cafeteria of Hebrew University in Jerusalem. His friends were killed, his wife seriously wounded. They eventually returned to the U.S. when Jamie, his wife, was able for travel. David is a writer. Writing is his craft. 4 years after the event, still deeply haunted by the whole ordeal, David begins to research the event in order to write about it. It's what he's been encouraged to do as an avenue toward his healing. While sifting through archived newspaper articles, he came upon the name of the person responsible for detonating the bomb, Mohammed Odeh. And it was reported that Mohammed told investigators he was sorry for what he had done, since so many people died in the attack. Coming upon that statement was huge for David for reasons he couldn't even begin to name. And he wondered, was it true? He writes, the only way you will know is to ask him, I thought. A nod came deep within me, without any rational understanding of the mechanics involved. A decision had been made. I would try to secure a meeting with Mohammed. The idea feeling shaky. Seeking a confrontation with the perpetrator of the bombing had never been placed on the buffet of potential treatments by those attempting to assist in my healing and recovery. I had heard of victims' intent on confronting their perpetrators. I knew about restorative justice. But such initiatives had always seemed bizarre, self-flagellating. However, after learning that Mohammed may have felt remorse, the word began to resonate with possibility, restoration. I sensed that the only way I might understand what happened was to understand Mohammed, an understanding which could somehow give me back my lungs, my life. And so begins this enormous process of seeking a meeting with Mohammed. So then we fast forward a number of months of endless correspondence, of questioning, what am I doing? Why on earth am I doing this? So now David is on the plane to Tel Aviv. It seems unlikely that he will gain access to the prison to meet with Mohammed. But Mohammed's family has agreed to meet with him. So here we catch up with him in the home of Mohammed's mother. Alongside David is Maryam, a woman who has agreed to act as translator. The old woman, the mother, sat down across from me. She turned to Maryam, seated nearby, and spoke in Arabic. She says that Mohammed's brother will be coming soon. I turned to Maryam. They know who I am, right? Yes, they know. Should I say anything? Wait until others come, and then we start. The thumping feet of children approached. I reached down into my bag and began rummaging. Is this a good time to give my gifts to the kids? I asked Maryam. Sure. She turned to the old woman who bellowed toward the window behind her. Sajida, Hamzi. The scurrying of feet on the front stoop intensified until suddenly two children stood before me. As they stared, smiling quizzically, the old woman pointed in my direction. I wondered what they had been told, if they understood, and so I asked. No, the children are too young. You are a friend of the father's. This is what they know. Maryam's words were gentle. Her tone suggested that this message did not belong to her, this notion of friendship between me and Mohammed. This is what I knew. They were children of a murderer. And this, I was not their father's friend. And this, they were beautiful. Hamzi, 11 years old, with short cropped hair, baggy jeans, and a mischievous grin, stood a distance away as I pulled a Rubik's Cube from my bag. When I was a child, I was given this puzzle as a gift, I said, more to the family than to him. But I could never solve it, and so I would peel off the stickers, rearrange them, and proudly show the solved cube to my friends and family. But they knew what I was up to, because the stickers were crooked. So don't peel the stickers. You won't fool anyone. Everyone looked to Miriam, then back to me, and then there was laughter. The family began pointing, and Hamzi approached, lifted the toy from my hand, and nodded a thank you. Then he darted out of the room. It was Sajida's turn. And she shuffled shyly toward me, stopping 2 feet away, smiling widely. Then she shuffled a bit closer and stopped again, as if playfully checking the ground for a trap door. When she moved forward again, her legs brushed against my knees, and her tiny hands were cupped below my chin. I placed the stencil set down into her palms and watched her receive it. Brown eyes open wide, wisps of dark hair falling over her face, mouth pressed into an embarrassed grin. There was chatter. The family says she loves art, translated Maryam, as Sajida pivoted and clasped the plastic to her chest, then hopped on 1 foot out of the room. I am not your father's friend, I thought, overwhelmed by their normalness. Then Samar, one of Muhammad's brothers, entered the room. He was wearing a black athletic jumpsuit, looking casual and relaxed, and a woman in full hijab was with him. She sat close to the door, as far from me as possible. The woman looked sunken, her face withdrawn inside the fabric, hugging her head, her eyes dark, staring at me, unblinking. Muhammad's wife. I feared her immediately, fingering the knife in my pocket. They say they're ready. You can begin, said Miriam. I looked at them, Muhammad's mother and Samar, looking perplexed but expectant, and said, when I tell people I'm coming to meet you, they often call me brave, which I sometimes think is strange. But I do think you are brave, inviting me into your home, knowing who I am, knowing what Muhammad did to my wife and friends. They nodded. We are glad you have come. I want you to know that I'm not here for revenge, that I have not come here out of anger. I simply want to understand you, to understand better Muhammad and how he could have done something so horrible. Whether we like it or not, we are connected by Muhammad's actions. And rather than think of you as enemies and forget about you, I've decided to try and understand who you are and how this could have happened. There was silence. Nothing. Then an eruption of Arabic cracked sharply across the room as Samar and Muhammad's mother began to speak urgently. Miriam tried to keep up. His mother says, Muhammad is a sensitive boy, so quiet. We didn't know, never knew. We would have done anything to stop him if only we knew. Samar says he broke. He would watch scenes of Palestinians being beaten on TV. Would sit and watch for hours. He would just sit. His mother wants you to know that he was jailed several times as a teenager. Twice. Once when he was 14 and again at 16. And he never talked about it. But we could see he was affected. He was so sensitive. Samar says Muhammad liked to pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. He wasn't at all that religious, but he liked it. And he would see his friends beaten by Israeli police, old people. He was humiliated by them, hassled by them. He just broke. His mother thinks that his other brothers were stronger. They could handle all of it. But Muhammad, I don't think he was strong enough. He wasn't strong enough. But if you could only know him, you would see he is a good person, a kind person. When they came and told us what Muhammad did, we didn't believe it. We thought it was lies, but we didn't know. We didn't know what he was doing. Don't blame us. We would have stopped him if we knew. We were in trauma for 3 months after. I raced to sort fact from fiction. The authentic stories of Muhammad's childhood from the lies his mother had to believe in order to remain sane. Muhammad is a kind person. I couldn't absorb it all as the Arabic poured in a steady stream. I turned to Miriam, then back to the family, then back to Miriam again, hoping that something synaptic would click and capture the conversation as accurately as the miniature tape recorder I'd left in my bag. I considered reaching for it, setting it up on the table and pressing record. But this wasn't an interview. It was a reckoning, or the prelude to one. I wasn't sure which. His mother says we visit him every month, and he tells us everything. He tells us nobody asks him about meeting you, that nobody has ever talked about it. He would agree if they asked him. I know they would agree. He wants to meet you. His mother says they don't let him touch the children. They kiss through the glass. He can't touch them. He wants to hold them. Why can't he hold me? Sajida asks. Tell them I can see this has been difficult for them as well, I said. Miriam translated, listened to their reply and turned to me. They say that Muhammad is sorry for what happened. He's sorry for what he did, for the people who died. If he could, he'd take it all back. He would change everything if he could. They want me to tell you that he said so, that he is remorseful. Samar leaned forward. Miriam spoke for him. Samar does not understand how you have come here without a gun. Why don't you have a gun? He asks you. If it were him, he would have a gun. He would be angry and doesn't understand why you don't have one. I looked at him, the knife tucked away in my pocket, hidden. What Muhammad did changed our lives and the lives of others forever, changed them in unspeakably painful ways. I've been struggling ever since, trying to heal, trying to get beyond what he did. I've tried many things. Nothing worked. Then I read in a newspaper that Muhammad expressed remorse and he was captured. And suddenly I knew I needed to try and speak with him, with you. Everyone was silent. I want to get past all this somehow, past his murdering of my friends, his harming my wife, past all the violence. I'm sick of violence. It may sound naive or cliched, but I want peace in my mind, between us. And if coming here can help bring that, then I don't know. It would be important, I think. As Miriam relayed my words in Arabic, a smile crept across Samar's face. Then he began to speak again, his eyes shifting shyly to the floor. Miriam translated. He says that he wants peace too, that they all do, and that he admires you for coming and thinks what you have done is brave, that it means a lot to them that you have come. He wishes there were more like you. There are, I said, nodding to Miriam. I promise, I'm not alone. I looked at Samar, looked at the family. Muhammad's mother said something to Miriam. She believes you, she says. I believe you. She says, will you continue to try and meet with my son? Are you going to keep trying? I looked at her and then at Samar, knowing I would never meet Muhammad. I will. Promise me you'll keep trying, promise me. I promise. I will keep trying, I said, unsure whether I would ever make the attempt again. So before he leaves on this particular visit, he makes this valiant effort to seek entrance to the prison. And he is not permitted. But so anxious to come home with something more, he finally arrives at being able to get this document of the court proceedings. And he's handed 50 pages. This is the last piece. Months later at home in North Carolina, with Hebrew-English dictionaries drawn across an oak desk, I would learn many things. I would learn that the attack was meant to have happened on July 28, 3 days prior to when the bomb went off. I would learn that Muhammad took the bomb to Ramallah for repair, for another attempt, the malfunction just a stumbling block, an obstacle around which to maneuver. I would learn that he was born in 1973, a year before me, that he returned home after successfully bombing Hebrew University on July 31st to his family and ate dinner. That he was captured at his home 3 weeks later, dragged away by police in front of his wife and son. That he had planned to bomb a supermarket in downtown Jerusalem. I would learn that Mohammed was recruited by the terror's cell leader, Abu Moaz. That Abu Moaz was impressed by Mohammed's determination, his creativity, his Israeli resident status. That Mohammed was convicted because of such determination. He wasn't deterred by the difficulties which stood in his path, the judge said. I would learn that Mohammed was a dedicated killer and that he was rewarded for such dedication with 9 counts of murder, 84 counts of attempted murder, 124 counts of providing aid for attempted murder, 5 counts of aiding the enemy during a war, 2 counts of giving information to the enemy, and 1 count of connection to the execution of murder. And I would learn other things. I would learn that Miriam was organizing peace initiatives amongst her East Jerusalem students, basketball games between Israeli and Palestinian children. I would learn that the O'Days had asked after me and my family, had extended an invitation to visit any time. I would learn that these people were now my friends, that I would expand the definition of friend to include them. And in including them, I would feel finished, feel done, feel that it was over, the journey at least, the traveling backwards, trying to unravel everything. Somehow meeting them, meeting the other side, the side responsible for what happened, along with the impersonal information coldly reflected in the court documents, had helped close a door ripped open by the attack. And though it was a door I couldn't lock, never learning firsthand if Muhammad's words of remorse were true, just closing the door was enough. Reconciliation. It had happened to some degree, and in happening had impressed upon me the force of restorative dialogue, its capacity for release, for unclogging the synaptic pores and letting loose all the filth which was contained within. I had not picked up a gun. I had not involuntarily sought revenge, nor had I succumbed to any form of demonic violence as a way to exact justice. I just got on a plane, sat on a couch, and provided an opportunity for my subconscious voice to say, as Miriam translated streams of Arabic, "My God, they are not monsters. They are not monsters." And in understanding this, they are not monsters, I understand that maybe there is hope for this world, for this land, for my people. Well, I wonder what it would be for us to attend to inspiration. As David did, as Elisha did, as unrealistic as that inspiration might seem. What would it be for us to wake up our capacity to imagine, to set our imaginations free, to allow ourselves to consider alternatives, to step out of our well-worn, time-honored ways as though they were the only one and discover a whole world of possibility? That's the practice that awaits us this week, if you haven't already seen it. It's about recovering our freedom to imagine. It's about waking up to the wild complexity of our world and our own creative essence. It's about cultivating the capacity to be open, to be alert, to be receptive to holy inspiration. For it is given to us to live creatively to the cry of the earth, to our own cry, to the trouble and the beauty of the world. And who knows what life-giving consequences are set in motion when we just simply make the first life-supporting step. Shall we imagine?